Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. In the seventh episode of my tracking series, I get out in the field with Brian Lichtenhan of Sky Island Alliance to volunteer doing some work in gathering data for a border wall study that the conservation organization is conducting. In this journalistic-style episode, we learn from Brian and the executive director of Sky Island Alliance, Luis Mistel, why wildlife migration corridors along the border are important, the threat that the looming border wall poses to these corridors, and how tracking supports SIA's efforts in collecting data to bolster conservation work towards preserving the area and the migration corridors used by many species. You'll also have an opportunity to learn tracking knowledge from Brian and get a peek into the minds of trackers as Brian and I attempt to decipher tracks and sign in real time. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Wilderness and Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, Ron Wallin. This podcast is an exploration of the ways that people can reconnect to the natural world through bushcraft, naturalist skills, and time spent immersed in the nature they find around and within them. We also discuss how this reconnection can increase our individual well-being and that of our communities and the earth. Thank you for joining me. I'm really glad you're here. Well, friends, welcome to this episode of the podcast. I'm really excited to finally be bringing this one to you. I actually did most of the work for this as far as recording and getting out in the field last June of 2020. And as things often go, stuff piled up and I never got to get to it and complete this episode. But here it is in all of its glory, finally. It was such an awesome day out in the field with Brian. And really enjoyed that and really excited to bring this podcast to you, this episode. And since it did take place last June, and it's a bit of a time-sensitive topic, I did have the privilege of getting to reconnect with Brian to have him come on and kind of bring us up to date. And that conversation took place February 3rd, so it's 2021, so it's very, very fresh. And for this episode in general, it is a new format. I've never tried this before, so I'll be really interested in your feedback about this more kind of journalistic style approach. But a lot of really great information from Brian and Luis, some great knowledge, a really, really interesting and important story. And this is just one of many conservation stories in this country and in this world right now that we're dealing with as far as losing species and cutting off migrations and you know, all the crazy environmental stuff that's going on right now. But what's really cool is the way that this data is being collected and the foundational role that tracking has played initially to kind of get this study started, because it, you know, provided the impetus for knowing that there's species there, of course, but also how it continues to provide foundational support along with you know, the main source of information, which is the images from the camera traps. But anyways, you'll learn about all that in the episode. So without any more fluff, here it is. Enjoy. Tracking is a skill that has been employed by humans since the dawn of time, used for procuring the needs of the group, obtaining information about the animals and plants of an area, the seasonal changes, and the movements of other people, whether friendly or hostile. Though technologies have changed and even enhanced many of our reconnaissance capabilities in regards to wildlife and human movements across the landscape, there are still situations and needs that only a skilled human tracker can fill. As a tracker myself, I am keenly aware of the capabilities of skilled trackers and maintain an insatiable curiosity of how trackers may apply their skill and in what ways those applications can benefit both people and wildlife. This curiosity led me to the San Rafael grasslands of the Sky Island region of southern Arizona near the border with Mexico. The Sky Island Alliance, a conservation organization based in Tucson, Arizona, is currently spearheading a comprehensive study on wildlife migration corridors. I plan to spend the day with Brian Lichtenhan, an employee for Sky Island Alliance and a highly skilled tracker and primitive skills practitioner. I arrived in the Patagonia Mountains the night previous to the day of our scheduled outing. As I set up camp for the evening, I marveled at the beautiful night sounds of the southern Arizona mountain range. I dozed off with the excitement and anticipation for the opportunity to spend some time exploring and tracking in this beautiful landscape. The darkness gave way to the increasingly faint light of the morning, heralded by the dawn chorus of birds that inhabit this unique ecosystem. Brian met me at my camp. I grabbed my essentials, masked up, and hopped in the back of his vehicle so that we could properly socially distance while traveling. Our task for the day? To change out batteries and SD cards in the camera traps being used for the border wildlife study, and to see what tracks we could find and document on the dirt roads running along the U.S.-Mexico international border. I'll allow Brian to introduce himself and explain who Sky Island Alliance is and what he does for them.
I'm Brian Lichtenhan, and I work with Sky Island Alliance to help monitor wildlife throughout the Sky Island region. And right now, what that means is I'm helping to check wildlife cameras, and I'm tracking along the border, and also helping to monitor springs in the region, water sources. And Sky Island Alliance is a conservation nonprofit based in Tucson, but working throughout the Sky Island region, which includes southern Arizona, like extreme south, western New Mexico, and then northwestern Chihuahua and northeastern Sonora in Mexico. So we work throughout that whole region on all sorts of conservation issues. Wildlife monitoring and protection, restoration projects, water sources, kind of monitoring and assessing water sources throughout the region, battling invasive species, and then also, at times we've, work on policy issues or advocacy of various sorts. And traditionally, the way we get most of our work done is with the help of a legion of volunteers that come out and join us, either on restoration type projects or get trained in monitoring springs or tracking or checking cameras and go out and do those things on their own.
Luis Mistel is the executive director for the Sky Island Alliance. I was able to catch up with her the week after this outing with Brian, and here Luis introduces herself and gives us a better understanding of how the Sky Island Alliance has used tracking over the years in its wildlife conservation efforts.
So my name's Luis Mistel. I'm executive director here at Sky Island Alliance. My work entails a lot of office work these days, but I was previously the conservation director, and I've been working here for 14 years now. I started as a volunteer, so I've had the great privilege of doing all kinds of different field work with the organization, developing programs to monitor springs and other things, learning about wildlife through the tracking work we do and the other wildlife monitoring work we do. So I've gotten to really do it all the last 14 years. Yeah, so we've been doing tracking work with trained volunteers for well over a decade. And we've used it for different kinds of ways to understand where wildlife is moving between different Sky Islands. It's also a really important way to engage people in the region and in understanding the wildlife that live here and how to look around them when they're walking, out in the Sky Islands and see who else in terms of wildlife is living and moving there. It's led us down all kinds of paths. We've been able to use tracking data that we've collected with citizen science volunteers in advocacy work to show that certain areas that were threatened by road expansion or other kinds of development were really important corridors for wildlife. And we often complement the tracking work with wildlife camera work. So the tracking work can help us get a sense of who's out there on the landscape in terms of critters. And then cameras can help us document wildlife in a way that we can really share with the public. Depending on the species, like for instance, with jaguars, we can use wildlife cameras to identify individuals, which you unfortunately can't do with the tracking.
Back in Brian's truck, we traveled down the dirt road towards the area in which we would be tracking and resupplying the camera traps with fresh SD cards and batteries. I began asking a few questions so I could get a better sense of the ecology of the region and why it is so unique.
So the Sky Island region is an area of mountains and lowlands, the lowlands being grasslands and deserts, that kind of bridges the gap between the Sierra Madre mountain range in Mexico and the Rocky Mountain system in the U.S. And we've got a lot of high elevation mountains separated from each other by these grasslands and deserts. So you get these kind of island-like habitats of these high elevation areas. So there are a lot of species that can only live at those in those certain ecosystems. And so they're kind of separated from other populations by those lowland areas. And this area has a lot of diversity because of that kind of geological diversity. You get a lot of different ecosystems. You get plant communities at the tops of those mountains that you would associate with like forests in Canada. And down in the lowlands, you get Sonoran Desert and Chihuahuan Desert and these grasslands. And so you have basically all the ecosystems from Mexico to Canada, generally speaking, represented here in this fairly small region, you know, in the southern U.S. and northern Mexico. And, so there's influences from all these different bioregions in the area. So you've got the Sonoran Desert on one side, the Chihuahuan Desert on the other side. You've got the Sierra Madre to the south, the Rocky Mountains to the north. You've got two rainy seasons, so you know it creates a lusher, greener desert than a lot of places. And you have a lot of subtropical influence kind of reaching its northernmost ranges up here, so you see a lot of tropical and subtropical species showing up here, but you also get a lot of those northern species kind of reaching their southern limits, you know. So, you know, like a black bears, for instance, are not very common south of the border. You know, they're in Mexico and in the Sierra Madre, but they kind of peter out as you go further south. And, similarly, like, you know, we've got coati and javelina and ocelots and jaguars that reach their northernmost extremes here, and also birds like the elegant trogon that kind of reaches its most northern limits in this area. So you've got all these influences from all different directions, you know, the different deserts, the tropics, the subtropics, these different mountain ranges and their species assemblages all coming together in one place, along with these weather patterns that create more, more moisture and than you find in a lot of other desert regions, and then that geological diversity, that elevational gradient. So all those things coming together makes this one of the most biodiverse places in North America. You know, it's just really, really a cool spot.
And so the uniqueness of this ecosystem, what does that mean for wildlife in this area, both the wildlife that's here all the time and that which is just migrating through?
Well, it means a lot, you know. I mean, for some species like the pronghorn that are here, you know, there's Arizona doesn't have a whole lot of intact grasslands. You know? I mean, there are some here and there, but this is an arid grassland. It's a dry grassland, and it changes a lot throughout the year. And the monsoons bring growth spurts, winter rain, spring growth spurts. You get different species that kind of thrive at different times of the year here. But so for some species, this is kind of like their refuge from surrounding ecosystems like the Sonoran Desert that kind of surround one. Once you get past the mountains around us, you might be dropping back down into the Sonoran Desert, and there wouldn't be habitat for a lot of these species anymore. So it's kind of a pocket of habitat for those species that require this kind of ecosystem. For a lot of other species, it's part of a migration corridor, perhaps, you know. Animals following the river corridors, animals following the mountain ranges, you know, whether they're a lower elevation species or higher elevation species, or whether they're a more general species that can go back and forth. A lot of animals move through this ecosystem. A lot of birds come here in the summer as part of the monsoon season to raise young, and that might be their only nesting for the year. It might be a second or even third nesting, you know, as birds have moved through the land and raise clutches along the way. Unbroken space, you know, which really a lot of species require, both to live year round or for the necessary migrations that they have to make. You know, like the fact that it's not, you know, there's this large area that is not developed, and that where this unique kind of ecosystem is still intact, is largely intact. You know, it certainly has been influenced a lot by human activities, but yeah, I don't know.
So what does that mean for conservation in the area? Like, what are things that we could be doing or trying to do better to continue to preserve this area?
Well, there's a lot of things. So this area, a lot of this grassland basin that we're in right now is actually a preserved as a state natural area. That's kind of laying that distinction on top of kind of the ranching and stuff that still happens here, you know. But it does help to kind of keep it maintained as open space, right? So that's important, but I mean, there's always so much more we can do, of course. You know, you'll notice that there are areas where there's erosion on the landscape, you know. If you pay much attention to the plant species that are here, the grasslands, there's a lot of non-native species in this grassland, you know. And in fact, the primary grass species out here is not a native grass species anymore. So, you know, there's certainly opportunities there for change. That's, you know, but there's a lot of people doing a lot of work around that, you know, work to diversify the plant assemblage out here, and on those issues of erosion, not just erosion, but actually holding moisture on the landscape, holding water on the landscape, and increasing water tables and stuff. You know, this region broadly has been losing so much of its groundwater, and that affects all the rivers, of course, and creeks and ecosystems, you know, as water becomes less available. So, yeah, there's a lot of opportunities and a lot of ways that we could be doing things better, or things that we could be doing out here too. including Skyland Alliance, but a number of other organizations as well.
At length, we arrived at the first camera to check. After parking, we walked some distance through the grassland to access the camera. I took the opportunity to inquire a bit more about this particular study and the goals of Sky Island Alliance and documenting the movements of wildlife in this corridor.
There are 48 cameras spread out, basically starting just the other side of these mountains and coming across the grassland and over into those mountains. So they're basically kind of a grid of cameras monitoring this whole section. And the reason we're monitoring this section is that currently there is no border wall through this section, but there is a plan for a border wall through this whole section. And once that is built, there will be very limited connectivity within the Sky Island region. Just a tiny little pocket, many, many miles that way. There will be a tiny little gap in these mountains, but all these lowland areas will be cut off, and a lot of the mountain areas too. So we're trying to get out ahead of that and document the wildlife that moves through the region and requires that in order to survive. And it might not be enough to stop this wall from going up, but hopefully it can be a part of the conversation that tears it down in the future. So we'll see. You know, I mean, certainly we hope we can stop it, but so far it hasn't seemed like any reasonable arguments have been able to stop the building. So
Luis also provided a great summary of Sky Island Alliance's efforts with this particular study, and also how tracking and camera traps complement one another in the collection of data.
So the Trump administration has been really fast-tracking border wall construction somewhat all along, but really in the last 6 months or so, there's been a big push for construction. And earlier this year, there was an additional waiver of dozens of laws put out by the administration in order to fast-track construction about 100 miles of new wall in Arizona. And part of that is through the Sky Island region. And so there's already a lot of border wall that is essentially impermeable to the wildlife we're talking about tracking. So, you know, critters that need to be able to move far and wide to reach food and mates and shelter, like black bears and mountain lions and jaguars, are stopped in their tracks by these large steel walls that are very tall and impermeable. But it's vital for lots of species to be able to move around. And there's a few pathways that are still open in the Sky Islands. There's a real vital pathway that has been an important route for jaguars to move into the United States from Mexico. So jaguars have been recovering in Arizona after being extirpated. And the nearest breeding population is in Sonora, Mexico, and they need these open cross-border pathways to be coming back into Arizona. But lots of other species also need those pathways and follow in their footsteps. So if this wall was to be built, it would completely sever the Sky Island region that we're talking about in two and make it impermeable to these animals. I mean, all kinds of animals, javelina, deer, some birds won't fly over these tall walls that they're building. I mean, it's just really a complete division of the ecoregion, and also of this area is an important continental crossroads in terms of migration. So really devastating. And it's proceeding outside the rule of law, so there's no assessment being done by the agencies doing this work. And it's going right through the heart of really special places that have been protected as national wildlife refuges, like the San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge, through the Coronado National Forest, and other places that the San Pedro Riparian National Conservation Area. So some of our real national gems in terms of wide open spaces and lots of animals relying on those places to live. There's a few places in the Sky Island region that are still completely open for wildlife to be able to move back and forth across the border. And those places are now under threat from this additional border wall construction. And so we've been monitoring wildlife in the borderlands for a long time using cameras and tracking transects. And last fall when we were out looking at some of these, revisiting some of these tracking transects, staff was looking at how there are tracks visible under the barbed wire fence that is currently what's at the U.S.-Mexico border in this pathway, and finding black bear tracks underneath, you know, with black bears moving underneath the barbed wire fence and coati and lots of other critters. And this threat was looming large, and so we felt like we needed to get a study in place for two reasons. One, to really document who's living and moving there right now, in case border wall was to move forward and be built there. It's really important information for us to understand the effect of border wall since the government's not studying that, and also to know where to take it down first if we begin restoration strategies. The other important piece, though, is communicating with the public what this place is, who lives here, what's really at stake if this border wall goes in, to try to raise public awareness. And so we put in a camera array of about 50 cameras in an area that we like to call the Path of the Jaguar. It's in the Huachuca Mountains, the San Rafael Valley, and the Patagonia Mountains in southern Arizona. And these cameras are arrayed in a grid. So we are arraying them in random points so that they're evenly spaced from each other. Often camera studies are done in a way that we think we know where wildlife are moving, and, you know, in riparian corridors or places like that. And so we put the cameras where we think we would expect to see wildlife. So this is really different. It's spread out across the landscape in a grid. And within all these different habitats in the Sky Islands, oak woodland and the San Rafael grasslands and up into some pine oak woodland. So what it allows us to do is really get a clear picture of the community of wildlife living there, and to capture, understand both wide-ranging species that are living here and species that may not be moving around. So far, so smaller species. And we're using this approach based on the TEAM protocol. It was developed in the tropics. It's the Tropical Ecosystem Assessment and Monitoring Protocol, and we adapted it to use in a linear fashion along the border. So tracking the tracking transects we had been maintaining in this area for several years were really important for us to start to get a sense of the diversity of wildlife moving here and how important this place was in terms of being a major pathway for wildlife. And so tracking it's a really wonderful tool when you have good substrate to track, but not all substrate allows tracks to be captured in the soil. And so it's limiting. You also can't necessarily tell different individuals or things like that. And you're obviously walking along where the substrate allows tracks to be seen. So it's a really wonderful tool to understand if and who is moving, you know, in these areas where we can capture tracks. But the cameras give us a whole nother set of eyes in terms of being in, seeing what animals are present in places where there isn't good tracking substrate. Tracks can be difficult to identify too, even for well-seasoned trackers, and substrate like loose sand and really squishy mud and all of that. So the cameras are much more accurate in terms of knowing pretty much for sure who's there.
Right.
So the two methods complement each other. And I think I mentioned this before, but the wonderful thing about the cameras in terms of reaching the public is, you know, photos really help people see who's here and engage them with all these amazing animals that live in this place.
Right. Yeah, I think there is a common misconception among people that aren't familiar with tracking how effective a good tracker can be at differentiating species and whatnot. And so I can see how the cameras would be really important for the public who doesn't quite maybe trust tracking as a data collection method.
Yeah, and we've worked for many years with trained volunteers, and which is wonderful, and we've been able to collect a lot of kind of baseline information, but it's really a challenging skill to develop over time. And so, you know, our ability to make scientific statements based on the tracking data we're collecting is pretty limited. And we just, you know, we don't have the staff capacity to have folks that are so well trained out all the time. So it's a really great first step, and gives us a sense of what's going on. And then the cameras allow us to say a lot more specifically about animals in the area.
Back in the field, after checking numerous cameras, and while walking back from checking our most recent one, Brian and I came across some scat that was characteristic of javelina. And since Brian did such a fantastic job at describing this scat and teaching about scat identification in general, and of course we can't have a tracking episode without geeking out on scat, I thought it appropriate to share his wisdom.
What makes for characteristic javelina scat for me, it reminds me of like human poop. Often it's like kind of, well, and of course even human, like all poop can change a lot depending on what something's eating, but I don't know, I guess it reminds me of my poop when I'm out like living off wild foods, I guess.
Right.
I mean, it's a little smaller diameter, but sometimes it can be bigger. These are both a little smaller than it can be. Right. But to me, it's like the texture of the material within the scat and then the texture of the scat itself. Like, they make these kind of logs, but they're not these well-formed logs like you get with a cat, you know, where everything's super densely packed and it's like kind of segmented really nicely. And it's not like a dog where there's like a clear twisting within the scat often, not always, but often. And like the surface texture to me always has these inconsistencies, these like rough parts to it, these lump, it's kind of lumpy and bumpy, and often stuff is kind of sticking out of the scat. Whereas like cat, you know, it's like super nicely well formed and smooth on the outside. And dog scat, I tend not to see that same kind of lumpiness unless it's like just full of tons of seeds and stuff. But then it looks kind of totally different too. But then inside the scat is all this plant material that's like broken up, but not to the point that like a deer breaks it up or like a cow or things like that. Like, I don't know if you noticed in that last one I pulled apart, like there's still like long pieces of grass, you know, like within it there's like bigger pieces of whatever vegetative material left over. It hasn't been ground down to that super fine uniform consistency that you'll see in a lot of other ungulates, you know. So yeah, and then javelina I often find kind of latrine sites where a lot of animals have pooped at once. You know, you'll occasionally come across like a single javelina scat, but more often than not, if you find one, you're going to find several within the area, you know? And that's pretty, you know, indicative of javelina, like kind of all those things together making for javelina. And, the scat also tends to hold its color inside for a long time. I've noticed, you know, I don't know. Like a cat scat as it ages and you break it open often is kind of gone crumbly and white. And I mean, they can hold their, I don't know. I don't know necessarily. So I don't think I have enough experience yet to really say like how quickly it ages, how quickly it loses that green color inside, loses the scent inside. But I've come across scat that seems like it's pretty old and still often has a bit of the greenish on the inside, even when.
So it sounds like in general, when you're looking at scat, you're not necessarily just looking for this one thing that says it's it. You're taking bits and pieces of information from
the entire setting, the entire scene, you know, the shape, the contents, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And using all that to point to one animal.
Yeah, right. Because like the overall size of this is similar to coyote, right? You know, and so how do you know it's not a coyote? Well, the context, you know, it's an associated with a lot of others. Now, could a coyote come here and put a scat next to these? For sure. Coyotes love to like mark around other animals. And this could be, you know, if this was like a convergence of several trails, you might have several different species all, you know, putting scat in the same general area. Looking at the texture, looking at the contents, you know, typically a scat this big from a coyote, I'd usually be seeing some fur in it. I'd be seeing maybe some bone, or I'd be seeing a lot of, seeds or things like that. Coyotes are not big grass eaters, but like all I'm seeing in this is grass, you know, like it'd be rare for a coyote to make entire meals of nothing but grass. Right. So it'd be a very odd coyote scat to just be this, you know, to be that size and be nothing but grass.
Nice.
It's like you said, it's a mixture of all these things, the context in which it is in and the contents, the shape, the size, all that.
At length, we were able to actually get to the border wall and see what we could find in the form of tracks on the dirt road running along it. The road itself consisted of very packed dirt, which didn't lend itself to being great tracking substrate. Regardless, we were able to find and document some more scat, a coyote skull, and do some back and forth questioning on some pockmarks in the ground that looked like feeding sign from some kind of hoofed animal, either coos deer or javelina, judging by the size. While the road itself did not hold clear prints, there were some pathways through and under the fence here and there that were obvious wildlife traversing points, and which provided some good substrate for clear identification of some tracks. After finding one good crossing point with clear bobcat tracks, I waved Brian over to come check it out.
The cats are focal species of ours too, so
good.
That's always really nice to find cat tracks. And yeah,
getting good clear ones too.
Yeah, for sure. And this is, it's just how the shape of this one is looking like a male, so it looks like a nice big male cat.
Good deal.
And there's another.
Oh yeah, look at
tracks.
It's spread out there.
And, yeah, it really spread out in the mud. I like this too because here we've got animals going both north and south.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a bobcat heading into Mexico from the U.S. We've got a skunk heading north out of Mexico into the U.S. So I think that's pretty cool to have.
And the coos looks like it's going into Mexico, whereas before.
Right.
The one we had last time was coming out.
Right. So, left front and we've.
After seeing some clear pronghorn prints, we did our best to decipher the trail, though with a few little mishaps, including the age-old tracker quandary of mistakenly stepping on the trail, and a near miss at almost accidentally crossing into Mexico while scanning for tracks under the barbed wire fence demarcating the border.
Well, look at that.
Oh.
That is a pretty big.
That looks more pronghorn.
Right, exactly.
Especially the way it tips out there.
Right, yeah. Shoot. I wonder if I'm stepping on more of that. But yeah, that those straight edges and a very triangular look to it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder this. And, you know, that last one we saw was so small, it would have had to be like a baby.
Right.
And this would be a great place for pronghorn. Do you want to check out the, do you see those?
Yeah.
I wish I had looked more carefully before I walked into this space. Be careful not to go into Mexico.
Yeah, I'm not.
Yeah.
Actually, I guess I am right on the line.
I guess that would be a big no-no. Not really seeing anything obvious.
So you said you're more familiar with their tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming that they're going to be mostly direct registering, like other ungulates.
Yeah.
Especially at slow speed. So right. I guess I should call this a rear foot.
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
Although it is awfully large.
It is, exactly. But to me, it seems too broad to really be a rear foot.
Right.
But then I'm like... You know, I like wasn't sure where, and then I saw this, and I don't know. But I don't see, like,
I mean, it's definitely...
Well, I don't know. There's, like, an edge here.
Yeah.
It could, but I don't know anymore. I've been messing everything up. But it does look broad to me, you know, for a rear foot. But it probably is a double register anyway, so it's not going to
be probably entirely, you know. Front and the rear.
Yeah.
Outline of the front and... Main shape of the rear. I mean, look at this though. There's one there.
Yeah.
One there.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, look at how. See, this looks again like that front foot here.
Yeah.
This looks the same.
Yeah, I don't think these are the same animal. Or if they are, they're not.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, not at the same time, but it does, you know, rear foot, front, you know, front foot, and then rear foot here. That narrower. Thing is definitely that's definitely looking
steeper slope from the rear to the
exactly front. yeah Very the front triangular. Is more broadly triangular at the bottom, the and the rear is more pinched at the bottom.
That means I'm probably stepping
so I think what I'm going to call this though is the front, because the overall width measurements I'm feeling like I'm going to have to go with that.
Moving along a little farther down the road, we came to another good spot.
There's, I just saw another puddle up here.
Oh, nice. Hey, here's some pretty, here's some ungulate tracks.
Yeah, I've got more here too.
I don't know, man. They're.
Some of these look like mule deer.
Look at this one though. This one's super triangular. Yeah, even. Because the wall, you're right, is just...
Yeah,
it's very... Yeah, it's very convex.
Yeah. That looks mule deer-y to me. But...
Yeah. Here's our skunk.
Yeah.
Came over here.
Yeah, I was seeing that right over here.
And that would make more sense for the size over there, too.
Well, the size actually was right at, like... For the length, that one?
Yeah.
That one actually was right
is
at
the
prong.
Okay.
Yeah. It was actually slightly small. Because it was only, it was 6 long, and they're showing 6.4 here.
Oh, okay.
I've still seen, like, I've seen pronghorn tracks out here where I saw the pronghorn make the track.
Oh, okay.
And they were more like 6
yeah.
and not quite 6.4. So
that's
I
good.
Think even this is a little skewed. But the outer edge was so straight compared to these.
It really was. These ones are very rounded, but that one was super straight and much more triangular. These are much more heart-shaped.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, even, I mean, it was straight all the way to the tip, you know?
Yeah.
All the way to the tip, whereas these are not. These are rounded all the way to the tip.
Right.
And a little bit farther down the road, we got into some jackrabbit sign.
What happened here?
I was kind of interested to see whether we would start seeing any toads yet. It is.
There's something going on here. Like this is a forelimb and.
Yeah.
Like he slid going that way.
Uh-huh.
Whatever it was.
It kind of looks jackrabbity to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Look at that.
And here's another dunk.
Yep. Good call.
Yeah.
There's something that's probably. I don't know. I don't see any nail marks here, though. But there isn't a real clear pad, which is indicative of a jackrabbit.
Yeah, and the shape of this is like, I mean, here's a nail.
Oh, right there, yeah, yeah.
But I think, yeah, anyway.
After our tracking geek out session, we finished the rest of our camera checks and called it a day. I was very grateful that Brian and Sky Island Alliance were willing to allow me to come out to learn and help volunteer for the day. After seeing the areas where the cameras were placed and having a better understanding of the ecosystem and how animals move within it from the day's experience, I was curious what kind of data had actually been collected thus far. Luis was able to satiate my curiosity.
So we've been collecting data for about 90 days, a little over 90 days, beginning of June. And we were stunned. We put the cameras out and we're trying to get back right away to check them to make sure everything was working right. And we were stunned how quickly we built a list of species, a diverse list of species. So over the last 90 days, we've seen about 45 different wildlife species. One thing that's been interesting with this study, because we're working in the San Rafael grassland, which is this really intact, open grassland area with not a lot of trees or shrubs or things like that, we've gotten a lot of amazing bird pictures, actually.
That's awesome.
Yeah, some really gorgeous bird photos and a wide diversity of birds. Most recently, we've had both mountain lion and black bear recorded on cameras in both the Huachuca Mountains and the Patagonia Mountains. And these are two of our widest ranging species in the region. So, it continues to show that this is a really important pathway for wildlife. We did a little bit of work to look at wind species were showing up on cameras in terms of daylight. And so right out of the gate, we had a lot of mammals showing up at night and twilight, which was interesting to see. So we don't have the data in yet as it's gotten really hot and analyzed in terms of those percentages, but we're interested to see how behavior changes, you know, with the changing temperatures and dryness right now in June. I think some of our more interesting species we've gotten on the cameras include the Montezuma quail, which is this really cute, cryptic quail that are pretty hard to spot. You often almost step on them before they flush if you're out hiking, and then you don't get a very good look at them because they've flown off to hide. So that was a fun one. And we had a badger in the first 90 days, which is wonderful to see. They're one of my favorites. But we've been getting, you know, what you would expect, gray fox, hooded skunk, kangaroo rat was another fun one that was a bit unexpected, mountain lion, black bear, bobcat, lots of mule deer and javelina, which are great food species for our four big cats here. Lots of turkey out there. And it's been fun to see all the different critters, and we have quite a chat going with staff virtually sharing photos and, you know, trying to figure out the ones that are kind of blurry and sharing fun photos that come in each day.
That's wonderful. Cool. And then how long do you expect this study to go for? Are you trying to do like a calendar year or?
Yeah, so we're actually hoping to keep it running for 2 years. The initial push was to get it in place before any of this wall was built and try to get some baseline data. And we're still working and hoping that the wall will not get built in this area. There's been some slowdown in this particular section, so that's good news. But we want to keep it going, and especially if the wall was to get built, to understand before and after, you know, the impact, and continue to be able to understand where the most important places are to start tearing the wall down.
Wonderful. And how can my listeners support you and Sky Island Alliance and what you all are doing down there?
Yeah. Thanks for asking that. So our website's a great place to start, skyislandalliance.org. You can sign up for our newsletter. We'll be having some volunteer opportunities coming up related to the Border Wildlife Study. If you are either in the area or are not and interested in helping online with photo identification, this study is the most comprehensive study we've undertaken as an organization on the border. So it takes a lot of staff time. So donations to sustain this work are welcome. It's really important to us that we keep collecting this data. So your support in that way is very much welcome. And you can find that on the ways to donate on the website as well. And spread the word. I mean, lots of people across the country still just do not realize what's happening on the border with this border wall construction. And they don't realize the amazing lands and animals that are being torn apart by this horrific wall. So spread the word.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Louise. Really, really appreciate you taking the time and helping us understand what's going on down there. And teaching us more about Sky Island Alliance and the Sky Island region. It really does sound like quite the gem. So appreciate you.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Since this outing took place in 2020 and all this was recorded back in the summer of 2020, I felt it was important to get an update on what the most recent information is coming out of the study. So fortunately, I was able to catch up with Brian and he was able to fill us in on that. Cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Brian. Great to reconnect with you after our day in the field last summer and excited to kind of hear an update. I just kind of wanted to get with you to find out what's going on. You know, we had our outing last summer and that was kind of not long after the border wall study kicked off. And I imagine there's been quite a bit of changes since then. Of course, there's a much different political atmosphere, as well as you guys have had over half a year to collect data. So really curious what you got on the cameras and any other updates you can tell us.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you can imagine, a lot has happened. And like you said, a lot has happened. But it's been going really well, actually. We've documented over 100 species at this point. 30 species of mammals, 38 birds, 23 insects, and a couple reptiles in there. And we're still occasionally adding species, and who knows? You know, that those numbers I gave you were from like December is the last kind of update I have. Over 2 million photos since March, actually. And of those, about 12,000 of those have been wildlife sightings. A lot of cool species have shown up. Black bear, mountain lion, coati, pronghorn, elf owls, all four of our skunk species, spotted striped hooded hognose. We've had porcupine, the Mexican subspecies of Virginia possum. So yeah, cool stuff.
Yeah, that's really fun. Any funny or anything that surprised you or anything like that?
I mean, the porcupine was certainly a surprise.
Yeah, that's what I thought when you said that.
Yeah, I mean, we've known they're around, but they're one of those species that kind of seems to fly under the radar a lot of the time. And I think a lot of people don't really associate it with Southern Arizona, you know? It was cool to get that documented. I've heard kind of anecdotally from people here and there of porcupine showing up in the Sky Islands. And I have yet to see one myself in person. So I was really excited when they started showing up on the camera.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. We've had also other things like we had a pig show up, a javelina, but like an actual pig. And we're definitely going to be monitoring that to see if that's like a lone escapee or if there's like a pop, you know, like if there's a group, if there could
like
be
a feral population establishing.
That would be a big deal. And definitely something we'd want to stay on top of. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. We'll interesting. See about that. Yeah.
And, any particular plans for the data set that you've got so far? Is this the kind of thing that's being disseminated to the public where people can go and see, or how does that work?
Yeah. I don't have the like latest on that, but we are going to publish, our findings from this, project for sure. I don't know what that timeline looks like, honestly. That's kind of outside of my purview right now.
Right.
But, no problem.
But yeah, we will be certainly reporting, and definitely we're, we'll be in contact with relevant agencies and so on. And, yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
And so you're really boots on the ground, of course, continuing on since last summer when we went out together. What is it looking like down there as far as the wall and.
Right. Well, yeah, obviously that's been one of the biggest developments. When we started this project, there was very little to no activity in the area where we set up the project. Since then, there's been a lot of construction. At the east end of our project area, at the southern end of the Huachuca Mountains, there's been a lot of project and sections of border fence or wall going up, but a lot of road construction, for sure, kind of in preparation for putting up those barriers. And then just like the last, week before, when was that? So it had been like mid January, at the west end of the project area, a contract was awarded for more border fencing that would have cut almost across the entire southern border of the Patagonia Mountains.
Wow.
And really quickly, within a few days, they had pushed a road through pretty deep into the foothills of the Patagonias. Fortunately, that order did come through from President Biden, and work has paused right now, but we honestly don't know long term whether that will be the end of it or not. I know this pause is really to kind of determine the legality of the funding for each of these projects, and all these projects have funding coming from multiple sources. It's going to be kind of hard to untangle all of that. And we don't know yet either, even if they don't build any more fencing, whether they might still, build roads, which would also, definitely have an impact on wildlife.
Wow.
But yeah, it's been pretty wild. I mean, both those areas, the Huachucas and the Patagonias, are designated critical jaguar habitat. And also both of those corridors have been known to be used by ocelot. So by cutting
and those come with, I would imagine that comes with certain legal protections and certain, reviews and, biological assessments and things like that, that come along with, construction of that kind, right?
Well, under normal circumstances, that might be so, but, right. Thanks to post 9/11 laws, Border Patrol is able to waive any and all, relevant environmental laws. So there, there's apparently been some effort to do some kind of biological assessments, but that really hasn't been in concert with any of the other agencies that would normally be involved with that. The fact that it's critical habitat, and the fact that, endangered species are at risk really has not played any role whatsoever in these projects.
Wow.
So it would be a real shame if those border structures are built. That would really impact the recovery of those species in the U.S. Right. For sure.
Yeah,
and obviously, this isn't the only area where that's an issue. Obviously, in Texas, we've seen the ocelot habitat being bisected by the wall.
Right.
We see it out west in Arizona, the Sonoran pronghorn being cut off from its larger population in Mexico. In the U.S., there's a very small group of those animals, and they've always needed to travel back and forth in order to have enough resources. So, this wall will have a huge impact on wildlife for sure.
Right.
And hopefully we won't see any more built, but that's really honestly still up in the air. It's a question up in the air, and we don't want to assume too much too soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, What could listeners do to help support conservation in that area, especially when it comes to the border wall? Are there certain legislators that need to be contacted, places to send funding, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, they'd of course be welcome to check out our website, skyislandalliance.org, and you can keep up to date with what's going on, what we're learning on our website. You know, if you are opposed to any more border infrastructure, you know, whether it be roads or walls or whatever, let your congresspeople, senators know, regardless of where you are, because, you know, these decisions are being made by the nation as a whole and by a lot of people who really haven't been down here, don't know the situation, and don't realize what's at stake. You know, this is one of the most biodiverse regions in North America, in the U.S. certainly. And yeah, we've got a lot of species at risk, and and a lot of just functioning ecosystems and habitats at risk. If all the projects that were planned go through, it will devastate the animal populations in the region.
Right.
And honestly, not do much at all in terms of the issues of, you know, immigration and drugs and all that stuff. All human beings find ways, you know, over, through, under, and around walls, but wildlife don't have those options. So really, this is affecting wildlife, and it's not really affecting the issues that it's supposedly addressing.
Right.
Yeah,
that's good to know. And on that note, I'm curious, and maybe it's too soon to tell with the camera traps, but with all the increased activity you're seeing just in the last few weeks to a month, are you seeing it affecting animal movements at all, wildlife movements?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a little early to say. We haven't really pulled much data from, like I said, this work at the west end of our project area just started a couple weeks ago, and basically has now started to, it's like kind of paused-ish. They're not like building border structures, but it seems like they're still kind of shoring up the road that they had pushed into it just to make it passable. So I don't know for sure on that west end what we'll see or how soon we'll see it. On the east end in the Huachucas, we've definitely noticed a difference over there in terms of like the numbers of species are actually lower in that section where there's been, you know, a lot of construction activity happening for a longer period of time. We're definitely seeing a drop off in the number of species there. I'm just kind of looking through my notes, but I think that's one of the big things right now. You know, those areas, the Huachucas and the Patagonias, are pretty similar. And the Patagonias have our highest numbers of observations. And the Huachucas are lowest. So obviously we're kind of going across three different habitats. It's not totally apples to apples comparison right now, but we'll know more when we have more data, and that's the point of all this. Yeah.
What I saw recently in the news, I think just within the last week or two, and I don't know when this was caught, but that there was credible jaguar sightings and even some photos. Obviously that didn't come from this study, or I'm sure you would have listed one of those. That's pretty exciting considering it's such a rare species that's seen in the area. It'd be cool if you guys were able to, you know, catch one of those on the camera.
Right. Yeah. You know, right now, as far as I know, we still have one jaguar and one ocelot, persisting in Arizona. The ocelot is actually just north of our study area in the Huachucas.
Oh, wow.
If those structures do get built across the southern extent of those mountains, like that would basically trap that ocelot in the U.S.
Yeah.
And that would kind of be the end of any hope for a population starting there. The jaguar is actually further to the east in the Chiricahua and Dos Cabezas Mountains. And there's actually, at the southern border of those mountains, there's a lot of activity happening as well. That's outside of our current study area, but it's certainly not outside of our regional area of interest. And yeah, there's been extensive work being done along the southern border of those mountains too. So, that could definitely impact whether that jaguar is able to continue to move back and forth and be a part of the population in northern Mexico and potentially, and the potential for, females to join that male here in the U.S. So, yeah, I mean, it's really cool that we still have those animals and, we just hope that this isn't the end of those species in the U.S. You know, we'd like to see those species coming back and those, some populations actually developing this side of the border. And that would not really be possible if these projects go ahead. So,
right. Well, yeah. It just highlights the critical and important work you guys are doing in collecting this. So really grateful for that and grateful that you can use your tracking skills and ecological knowledge to help, kind of tell the broader story and figure out what these animals need, how this is going to impact them and where we can do the most good, to hopefully stop the wall. And if not, at least know where the first place is we need to tear it down. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. Just looking to see if there's any other interesting stuff we've come up with. Another interesting thing, is that, 71% of our mammal detections so far have been at night. Not surprising necessarily, but, as part of the plans for these border projects, they include lighting all along the structures,
yeah.
So there'd be bright lighting all night, which would definitely have an impact, on the activity of animals and, not just mammals, but, birds and bats, obviously it would affect.
I was just going to say, we have the saguaro cactus is pollinated by bats and a lot of agaves and all that. So that's going to really hamper that effort.
Yeah. I think that's, a little known issue that lighting really can affect those night migrating species, attract them and to the point of sometimes really exhausting animals at night, just kind of flying around these lights. So yeah, that would, not only, I think most people think of that border structures as really impacting those terrestrial species, but really it would have effects beyond that. And
That's a good tidbit. I never considered the lighting issue, but that's a huge one.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks, Brian. Appreciate you taking the time to come on and give us a good update and some more context as to what's going on more recently. Appreciate that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I appreciate it too. And look forward to hearing the podcast. And thanks again for your interest in our study.
Well, friends, that's a wrap as far as the episode goes. I hope you really enjoyed this new format that I tried out. Don't expect I will do this again anytime soon, but it was a fun project, if not a little more work. But I hope it came across well and you're able to learn a lot about tracking and conservation work and especially the issues going on down with the border wall construction and the wildlife migration corridors. Definitely go check out Sky Island Alliance's website. I got it in the show notes. There is a link. See what you can do to, at the very least, inform yourself of the kinds of things that are going on down there. And, if possible, be able to contribute somehow, some way to the cause, whether it's contacting your representatives or whatever, that would be greatly appreciated. And,
And at the very least, there's some really cool information there. They are posting updates on the Border Wildlife Study. And so definitely go check that out. As always, appreciate any feedback you can give, whether it's an email, a message on social media, a comment and a post, but especially reviews. I don't know that I've talked about this at all, but I'm not making any money on this podcast, and that's not really my goal here. My goal is really just to share my love and knowledge and share the great relationships that I've made over the years with others and the expertise that has come with that. And so, you know, I am supporting this podcast on my own monetarily as far as the hosting fees and everything that goes with that. And I've really, even though I've had many offers, I've shied away from doing ads and promotions and things like that. So really I'm in it for the passion and the love of it. And anything you could do to help me along to spread that passion, spread that message is greatly appreciated. And the chief ways you can do that is by writing reviews, sharing posts, and really just sharing with your friends, you know, texting them a link to an episode that maybe touched you or whatever. Just wanting to spread the love, spread the message, help get people outdoors, and help us all gain the health benefits and wellness benefits of the natural world. And of course, help to protect, preserve the environment as a whole, and help ourselves in the same way, because we're it and it is us. You can email me ron@coyotespath.com. You can find us, of course, on Facebook, Instagram, and reviews are best left at Apple Podcasts. But wherever it is you're accessing this podcast, if there's a way to leave a review, greatly appreciate it. So with that, I will leave you to it. Happy trails until our next episode.